Every day, you can practice learning Italian on an app. You can make pasta. You can make pizza. You could have new experiences that enrich your life that are really small, really easy, not super time-consuming, not expensive, that lead into these bigger goals.
We just realized, like, we would have taken those experiences over any amount of money, any amount of, like, you know, physical goods. Like, there's just no comparison. That gives you the urgency to say, like, why am I not doing any of the things that are important to me?
The regret that people have for the end of their life is all the things they never tried. It's not the stuff they tried and failed. It's the stuff that they never actually took a shot at because they don't know. They don't know what would have happened, what they could have done, or what they could have become.
Welcome to the Stubbornly Young podcast for people in their 50s, 60s, and beyond who want to remain engaged in the world and relevant to the younger people in their lives. I'm Dave Tabor, and this episode is based on a book recommended by Chris Shembra in episode 11. The book is called Experiential Billionaire, Build a Life Rich in Experiences and Die with No Regrets. Authors Bridget Hilton and Joe Huff are my guests on this episode. So cool, and thanks to Chris for connecting us. As part of reading Experiential Billionaire, I stopped almost at the very beginning. I stopped reading it to start building a spreadsheet list of what feels to me are key experiences in my life, experiences that already make me feel like an experiential billionaire. And that makes me encouraged to consider what's next. What better way and what a privilege to discuss this topic with the book's authors, Bridget and Joe. Glad you're joining me here on Stubbornly Young.
Thanks for having us.
I've been looking forward to this for weeks, and I've been talking about it with friends, talking about your book with friends. We're all pretty jazzed about it. So let's start with the origin story, sort of this whole notion behind being an experiential billionaire.
Leading up, though, to my adolescent years, I had a pretty rough go in high school. I actually got kicked out of high school. I more or less was kind of on the wrong path, and I think a lot of people can identify with, you know, that story, or at least being pretty confused about, you know, life and what it's about when they're at that age. And what saved me was something that I think we hear these stories kind of a lot also is, a near-death experience in my family happened. And, you know, that really woke me up. It really shook me. It gave me this urgency that I didn't actually have a guarantee on how much time that I have in my life to actually, you know, fulfill my goals and live my dreams.
At the time, did you feel as though, Joe, that you were really chasing experiences? Did you feel that, or were you just like, didn't know what you wanted to do, so you were trying a bunch of stuff?
Yeah, you know, I would say a bit of both, you know, like I didn't have like the resources. I definitely didn't have the money, and I had, you know, a limited ability. I didn't have any connections or anything like that. So it was more of like, what could I do to fill up my time? Because I was aware of the time constraint of life suddenly, right? So it was experiences. But what was really interesting is as I did those things, they gave me the confidence to try more things. And then the more things I did, the more people I met. And then the more people I met, the more doors opened to try more new things. And that's when I really started to understand, I think, the value of life is about our experiences and then the connections that we make throughout those experiences.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting to me, and I'm looking, we hadn't met before we got together on to do this episode, and you're clearly younger than I am, as is Bridget. And what I took from the title, and Bridget, you can jump right in here, but what I took from the title is more of a sort of a contemplative notion of, hey, we're seeing, like, we've reached a point in our lives where we're starting to say, you know, how do I want to explore what's left? Right. And you're both way younger than I would have expected related to this topic. Bridget, what am I missing here?
Maybe.
Wait, guess our ages. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Bridget, what do you think about that? I mean, that's what it struck me as, but I may have been, based on what Joe said, I may have been missing it altogether.
I mean, I think it's both. I think it, you know, we work with a lot of people that are older and they're seeing that, you know, for the first time in their life, they're like, oh, this is what really matters. And I'm going to spend the rest of my life feeling that way. But it's also extremely impactful to work with young people and like people that are in college, for example. We do a lot of speaking at universities and to get them before they kind of go down this path and like waste a lot of their time, like just chasing the things and just chasing the money versus like living in the now. Like, I think that's just as impactful as like somebody that's older, you know. It's just interesting.
Yeah. So I mentioned in the intro that I started building like right away. I all of a sudden was like excited to build this spreadsheet of what have I done already in my life that makes me feel like I'm already an experiential billionaire. And so I made this list, which was, you know, it's super inspiring to me. And then my wife made a list and she was thinking of things that I hadn't thought of that we had done together and vice versa. But as you think about it, being an experiential, I mean, does that make sense to you to like reflect backwards as well as forward around this whole notion of being an experiential billionaire?
You know, it's funny is that I originally didn't even think of that. But then I had like multiple people like you say that. Like I wrote down what, I mean, after they wrote the book or after they read the book, they were like, okay, I'm going to write down all the things that were the most valuable, which is funny because like when we did this big survey of when we were writing the book, we did a survey of 20,000 people. And one of the questions was, what did you value the most in your life? And that was like, you know, confirms the thesis of the book that people don't value the things. They don't value the bank accounts. They value the experience that they have. So, yeah, I mean, you're right on track for sure.
Well, I was looking at some of the things and they almost like the things I sort of created like a bar. And I'm like, okay, things above this bar are things I'm going to consider as part of sort of this experiential billionaire aspect of my life. And so those were things that tended to give me a shot of dopamine. Like when I thought about it, I smiled. And other things I chose were sort of under the bar. So, you know, like I spent a year as an NFL mascot. That was like a dopamine hit when I thought about it. You know, I dove super deep in Belize. That was like, it gave me a dopamine hit to think about it. And there's like these things, watching my kids being born, you know, is there a bar for what falls into the category of an experience that makes you a billionaire?
I mean, we have like five like bars, I guess I would say, to having that in the book. And the first one is like, does it support your well-being? You know, like, is it like giving you, you know, that dopamine? Is it giving you like a relief of stress? Is it giving you like making you healthier? And the second one is, does it nurture relationships? And, you know, obviously like experiences build relationships. So it's part of that. The third one is, does it make you grow like as a person? Like, are you exploring and discovering new things and like learning something? Maybe you're learning guitar or Spanish or whatever it is. The next one is, does it bring you joy? And obviously that's like, you know, around the play concept and like just constantly playing as an adult and not forgetting about that point of view. And then the last one is, does it serve others? Which is obviously a huge part of our story. And like we do anything to serve others, hopefully, you know.
Well, yeah, it really actually became a point of reflection for me as I looked at my list. You know, how many of them were about me? How many of them were about my family? And how many of them were about others? And it helped me sort of evaluate, I guess, how I'm leaning into this.
Yeah. Well, it's important to do things for you as well. You know, if like you are the best version of yourself, that's only going to help your, you know, family, your partner, your business partners, et cetera.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it too just really comes down to potential, right? Like feeling like you lived up to your potential in any area is like a really powerful feeling. And if your potential was any one of those things, if you think, you know, you wanted to be a mascot or you wanted to explore starting a family or whatever those things are, those are those things that you have this feeling of, yeah, I put it all out there. I didn't leave something on the field. You know, like actually I tried for it. And that's why it can really go across any kind of category, any kind of level. And to Bridget's point about like the study, you know, we came to this, you know, realization after our own journey and after like being able to help a lot of people through our company and have all these crazy experiences. And we realizing that that's what mattered most to us. And if, you know, something happened suddenly tragically right now, we wouldn't change anything because, you know, we had this incredible story to tell. We had this incredible life, you know, story that we wrote where, you know, a lot of people I think are putting things off for this future that just might not exist. And that's crazy concept.
Well, I got a bunch of questions to dig in, but first I want to kind of level set a little bit with both of you because those of us who aren't yet retired, I mean, we still have day-to-day lives. We still have to go home and make dinner and pay the bills and take out the trash. And, you know, how do you figure this notion of balancing experiences that make you an experiential billionaire and weaving those into those mundane aspects of life, even work, which may not be mundane, but it doesn't necessarily make the list.
just stop taking out the trash. That's the first step. Just make room.
That's brilliant advice.
Come on,
hoarder. Yeah. No, you know, again, like I think that the thing that people overlook, or at least one of the biggest roadblocks for people to take any type of action, is they think it has to be Mount Everest. It has to be overwater bungalows. It has to be this big, you know, bucket list experience to have value. But there's so much value in the day to day. And that's what the study shows. And that's what, you know, when you think about the compound interest, right, where if you do little things that give you joy every day, you can build a lot of experiential wealth throughout the year. And that's a really powerful way to, you know, reframe time you have in the day.
Let me push back on that, because it almost, what you said to me almost strikes me as counter to what your whole message of your book is, because living day to day isn't, like, I don't know, it just doesn't seem like the way to become an experiential billionaire is just looking for moments. I don't know. It doesn't, like, it's not the list I built.
That they're coordinated. They're connected, right? We have a low to high ROI kind of concept that we talk about in the book, where if you want to, for instance, if a dream of yours is go to Italy, and you don't know how to do it, right? You can start by planning the trip, even if it takes a year or 2 years or however long. But then along the way, like every day, you can practice learning Italian on an app. You can make pasta. You can make pizza. You could have new experiences that enrich your life that are really small, really easy, not super time consuming, not expensive, that lead into these bigger goals. And the more you do that and you bring more people into the mix, you wind up building like, a like-minded community of people around you and relationships that are deep and meaningful. And it just helps you achieve those goals together.
It also just like depends on what you're into, you know, like maybe Joe is super into action sports. And like, so in his mind, like he's like an experiential builder because he's like, I'm going to go surfing and I'm going to go like skiing and snowboarding and like, you know, name any sport, like say that's his thing and say like, I mean, this is true for me. Like, I'm really into food. So like for me, like I cook stuff, different stuff, at, like almost every single day. So that's part of my day to day is like learning new things, right? And learning how to cook new things. But also like, you know, in the past, like I've gone to school, like farm school, which is super random. And then like, you know, I take cooking classes all the time. I like, you know, even if I'm just looking stuff up on YouTube, it's still like constantly learning and like building to being like, you know, like I have a billion experiences with food, and like most people, like sadly, will just order the same things over and over again, or like make the same things at home. And like, especially if you have kids, this is really important because you're like teaching them how to like make new things and learn new things.
Yeah, I think that the big message is that, you know, you have to work within the parameters, right? We all have jobs, we all have things we have to do, we all have constraints. So if we actually let that be like the you know, reason, then we'll always have a reason not to look for things to do. And the number one reasons that we found were always the same. It was, I don't have the time, I don't have the money, or I just never got around to it. Now, those things are pretty connected in a lot of ways, but realistically, when you think about like how much time we all have, how much time are you really wasting a day? Most people, you know, they definitely are on their phone. They're definitely watching some Netflix, definitely doing some things that's not bad. You can do those things. Of course, we're all going to do that, but are you doing it mindlessly? Is it becoming something that's actually stealing your time, where you're just like wasting time, killing time, instead of filling that time with maybe something that has value leading up to bigger things?
Yeah.
The big point about what Bridget said is figuring out what you want. Like, that is so important. If you don't stop, like you made a list, Dave, that's such a great step. So many people, they don't have a list. They don't even know what to do, right?
Yeah. Is that, I'd ask you both. I mean, I stopped like in the first chapter to start making this list, and I've been working on it, toying with it since then. It's been kind of a fun exercise. My list of what I want to do is way shorter. I mean, you know, than the list of what I've already done. So I'm really toying with that notion too. But is there an exercise that you recommend for your readers as like a starting initiative that is fun and interesting to get them energized around being an experiential billionaire?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the exercise you're talking about is the perfect starting point. It's called the treasure map exercise, and it's kind of the cornerstone exercise in our book. And we take readers like through this exercise and then through the path of like completing those items on the list. And so the basics of it is like, imagine your doctor just called and they've got really bad news.
Yeah.
You know, you only have a year to live. So think about what you could realistically do in that year that you've always wanted to do and the things that you've maybe told yourself, like, I'm going to do that someday, right? But now someday is not ever going to come. Like, you only have a year left. So write down the things that you want to do in the last year of your life.
Yeah.
And then from there, we take it shorter and we go to 30 days and then to one day. And of course, like, nobody wants to like travel the world on the one, you know, 24 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you know, call my parents, like hang out with my kids, you know, like forgive
everybody,
tell someone you love them, you know, stuff like that. But then on the 1 year list, it's always really interesting to see like what people write. And a lot of it is travel. A lot of it's learning things or, you know, writing a book or like, you know, getting this dream out that they've always had. And then it's like, you look at all these lists side by side. And the most important part of the exercise is to like put an asterisk next to like what you're currently working on. If you're like most people that do this exercise, there's 0 to 1 items that they're currently working on. So it's like that instills the urgency that, like, you know, a near-death experience hopefully doesn't happen to you.
Yeah, yeah.
But that gives you the urgency to say, like, why am I not doing any of the things that are important to me right now?
Well, okay, so you use the word important. And I think that's interesting because one of the things I had is like, we think about, there's that song, Riding a Bull Named Fu Manchu, whatever. The idea is like, if you have no time left, you know, what do you really want to do? What do you really want to do? And it seems like there's a difference between what's important to us maybe and these crazy ideas of extreme and outrageous and bizarre activities. Like, you know, I'm going to run with the bulls or I'm going to skydive. Oh, you know, like, I guess you could have some of those on your list, but is that really what's important to most people?
That's usually not what's important to most people. Usually it's something more fulfilling or something like a dream that they have. But like a lot of people did say skydiving, right? And it's like, why?
Yeah.
If that's important to you, it only takes one day, right? And it's a $100.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not hard. That's the thing. There's so many of the things people said were, you know, the vast majority were very achievable goals. Very, very achievable goals.
So what do you think they're, if it's very achievable, they've always wanted to do it, it takes one day and a few $100s, why haven't they done it?
Because they think there's more time. Because then they'll be like, oh, I'm gonna like say I was like, you know, I want to write a book, but I'm just gonna do that someday.
Yeah.
It's like, but that takes a lot of like time to like put into it. Why don't you start now and then maybe it'll get done in a couple of years or something? But if you start now, that's, you're gonna save all that time.
Well, let's use skydiving as an example though.
Yeah.
Why do you think if there are so many people who say they want to do it, they haven't done it? Do they really, really want to do it? Or are they just saying that because it sounds cool, it feels cool?
I feel like with that specific example, it's something that's, it's obviously around fear, right? Like most people are scared of jumping out of a plane, which is totally acceptable.
Yes.
But it's also the fact that like when you see somebody do it, when you see your friends do it, you're like, I wish I was more like them. I want to be that type of person that does that. And so they want to be like them.
But isn't that worth exploring? The idea like is what's going to really make you feel like an experiential billionaire, something that makes you feel like others, or is it something different?
I think it's about the overcoming fear and taking action. It's about realizing that so many of the things that you want in your life are only not happening. They're only not happening because you're afraid. You're afraid to take action. So that's really, I think, the underlying message to all of it.
So skydiving is more of a metaphor for all the things that we haven't done.
And honestly, it is in a lot of ways, because it's not too hard for anyone to actually make that dream come true. But, you know, people, again, they put it off because they think they have more time. And then, you know, it's just one of those things that they'll look back later and go, gosh, I never did it. You know, I wish I had. Yeah.
And there's really no excuse for that example other than fear. You know, like I could go online and book it right now and go tomorrow if I wanted to.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's fine to actually determine that you're actually, you know what, I am afraid and I don't want to do it. That's fine too. And like, that's really, it's all about really just identifying, like you said, the things that actually have value versus things that you just thought sounded big and cool and interesting for your life story.
Hey, Bridget, we kind of jumped right into a bunch of my curiosity questions, but I'm not sure we spent enough time talking about the concept of experiential billionaire versus what Joe was mentioning earlier that, you know, college kids want to chase, you know, a job that pays, you know, so talk more about what you've seen around this idea of people pursuing a life where they become an experiential billionaire versus whatever else they might have thought they had in mind.
Sure. I mean, I can just give you super quick backstory on how it kind of came to be and why we named it all of that. And it's a good example of what you're just saying. So, long story short, I grew up in Flint, Michigan. My whole family works for the auto industry, and I never was interested in that. I was always obsessed with music. That was like my big dream in life. And I really put everything on the line in like since I was a kid to get to that dream. And I went from like sleeping in my car and like, literally picking up trash at concert venues to like fast forward to like working with like Taylor Swift and The Weeknd and Rihanna and like all these like huge superstars, like when they were first starting out. And one day in my office, I saw a video of a woman hearing for the first time, and she was like the same age as me. And it got me thinking about like how crucial like following my dream of music was to like where I got. And I was like, wow, I want to do that for someone. I want to like, have them hear. Like, that's such a cool experience. And basically, like after seeing that video, I sent the video to Joe, and we created this company called Listen. And what we do is we sell headphones and speakers, and we give the proceeds to giving people hearing aids around the world. And since 2012, we've given over 50,000 people the gift of hearing for the first time.
Wow.
So, and we've traveled to like 40 countries and like just had the most epic experiences of all time. Like it's by far the greatest thing like I've ever done in my life.
So now keep tying it into where your book is.
So during this time, like we were just kept doing all these awesome things and like really seeing the world and like giving back and all these like very fulfilling things. And we were, like around all these people that had companies or whatever, and they would all be like, oh my God, it looks like you guys are killing it. And like, kind of like implying that we were like financially wealthy, which is funny because like we were doing okay. Like, we were paying our bills and like we were like, living out our dreams, but we were never like Beats, like Dr. Dre billionaires. And so we would respond and be like, yeah, we're doing okay, but we're not like, we're not billionaires. We're like experiential billionaires. And so that was kind of like always an inside joke with me and Joe for years. And then, over time it evolved. And like in 2020, when like the world shut down, we couldn't travel the world and like, give people hearing. So we started writing the book then, it about our experiences. And that's what led to like, when we were researching for the book, we started doing the big survey of 20,000 people and like, it was like a whole, it kind of all culminated like around 2020, 2021. And like, we just realized like we would have taken those experiences over any amount of money, any amount of like, physical goods. Like, there's just no comparison to that.
Yeah. It was a combination of experiences that were fascinating, interesting, exciting for you, and also where you were contributing to others. It was some mix of the two, right?
And there's this whole thing of like, philanthropy, like in general, where people say, I can't do anything when I'm young. Like, I have to wait until I'm like 80 years old. And that's just not true. And it's something that people put off until this quote someday and then might not ever get to. But it's like the most fulfilling thing in the world is like, is giving to others.
And do you think ultimately becoming successful as an experiential billionaire is a combination of both giving to others and doing things that just are personally exciting? Is there a perfect mix?
Yeah, I think again, it's like that. It's that potential thing. It's knowing that you really did the work. You were intentional. You thought about what you wanted, and you tried. It doesn't mean you succeeded. It's not the outcomes. It's the actual action. If you go for it and you get knocked down a bunch of times, you'll look back and go, "I went for it." The worst feeling, I think, the regret that people have toward the end of their life is all the things they never tried. It's not the stuff they tried and failed. It's the stuff that they never actually took a shot at because they don't know. They don't know what would have happened, what they could have done, what they could have become. And it's crazy because in the study, everybody knows this stuff. Like when we asked people, what matters most, they all listed off all these things that they wanted to do that they could do. But we just have this like, glitch in our matrix. Humans just kind of put this thing, they know it, but they don't act it. And that's really wild. And we're even guilty of it ourselves still. We have to step back and go, wait a minute, are we still doing all the stuff we want to do?
That really gave me a light bulb went off when you said that because, I don't believe the people, all these zillions of people they you hear interviewed. Oh, I have no regrets. I have no regrets. Of course, people have regrets. We all have regrets, one thing or another. But the idea is that what we really regret isn't what we failed at, it's that we what we didn't try. That's really a profound comment to me.
Yeah. And you never know what you will like if you don't try. You know, like simple as like, okay, like I was like, it would be fun to run a race or whatever. You know, that's like on a lot of people's like list is like running.
Right. I'm going to run a marathon.
Yay. Yeah. Like, and so I did it and I honestly hated it. And I was like, I'm never going to do that again.
but you like, did it once.
Right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you try surfing.
Yeah. Exactly. So like, I don't want to like do that anymore. And I'm super glad that I did it. I'm like proud of myself for doing it. But then it's like, I'll try surfing, for example. And I was always like, oh, I'm afraid of what people might think. And like, I'll probably look dumb or whatever. And then I did it. And I was like, you know, of course, no one's good at it right away. So like, I did it, I kept trying. And that now I can like surf. And I love it. I'm never going to like win the Olympics. But
yeah. That's cool. One thought, too, is you're talking about this, it reminded me of something went through my mind. I'm fortunate because when I built my list and my wife built her list, we had tons of overlap. And we do a lot of things that we consider experiential billionaire sort of categories. We do together and we enjoy them together. I'm sure a lot of people that you speak with and that I know aren't as fortunate, where their spouses may not have the same aspirations of whatever experience that would be. You know, what do you recommend in those scenarios? Because that must be fairly common.
Yeah, I think it takes work with most, you know, it's like if you think of it like more or less like a company, a relationship requires, you know, multiple input. There's one real end goal, but at the same time, there's divisions, you know, so
divisions
have needs. So, you know, you just have to find that balance. You know, there's no magic bullet for relationship success. And that's definitely not the next book we write, but.
That could have more complexities in some ways, but yeah.
There's going to be overlap though. Like saying like, you know, both people write something down. Like there's going to be like one thing at least that they can do.
Yeah. So look for the overlap. Look for the overlap. Yeah.
Well, I think that, you know, it's funny because this ties really into the learning and doing new things we talked about in the book and in one of the chapters. And really, you don't really know what you like or don't like until you've tried it. And to your point, you know, that you just said this a moment ago, right? Like when we actually do these new things and you find those new things, that maybe there is something that your other half actually likes or you both like that neither of you have tried, right? So that's what exploration is. And then the more things that you know how to do together or individually, then that gives you this collective, you know, you become better at a lot of other things because it generally is how things work.
That shared moment of, wow, we both like this and we never tried it before could be super cool. And you mentioned something about learning, and I wanted to ask you a question about your chapter called Unlock the Vault of Lifelong Learning. And that really resonated with me because I've been slowly trying to learn Spanish. And I realized I laughed when I wrote that because slowly trying is not a very positive force to drive an outcome. But you know, here's what the question in the back of my mind, and that's that people say that specifically to Spanish, but it could probably apply to other things. People say that as an adult, it's really hard to learn a new language. So the question I ask myself, like, am I too old to learn to reach a proficiency that I really, you know, it would really bring me joy? And I realize as I asked, if you were sitting next to you, you'd probably slap me. But I mean, are there sort of stages in life when you've seen people evaluate what they want to try differently?
I mean, yeah, I think that certain things and certain people for sure, but I definitely don't think there's like an age limit for just about anything, you know, because learning new things, just it expands your identity. And it's just that really solid investment in yourself, right? Where if, for instance, you want to learn Spanish, yeah, maybe you're not going to, you know, be delivering a keynote in Spanish in, you know, somewhere in Mexico or Spain anytime soon, but you could definitely communicate and then you'll have a much greater understanding perhaps of that culture or when you travel, et cetera. And I just think that, you know, if you use those kinds of generalizations of like, it's too old to try or start, you know, it's just going to stop you from learning something. I'm 53, by the way, and I didn't start mountain biking until I was 48 years old and absolutely love it. And like,
so those first hard falls really hurt.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. You know, are you simply mountain bike today? I don't know. Cause it's a pretty impactful sport, both the personal and physically. But yeah, you know, I think that, you know, if I had listened to, you know, I'm sure my doctors or, you know, general medical advice or just, you know, my wife, I'm sure most people would say you probably shouldn't start or try that. But, you know, really, I think that you just have to figure out what you still want. And, you know, there's people that I think we all have heard the stories, and this is why these stories go around and everybody reads them, you know, stories about like people that are in their 80s that run marathons, you know, 10 times a year. You know, what makes them different? You know, what makes them different? That they said they're going to do it and that they want to do it and they did it. You know, like anybody can try to do something new and different that's, you know, at any age.
To what you just said, Joe, how much, you talk about the 80-year-old who's continuing to run a marathon or whatever the case. I just watched the movie Naiad about the swimmer who swam from Cuba to the U.S. True story, pretty interesting. How much of what people should do or think about doing that makes them an experiential billionaire is done because of what other people will think of them?
Yeah, no, that's a really big one, you know, and I think that this is, again, to go back to the treasure map exercise. Once people write down all the things that they really want to do and they say matter most to them, the next step we say is look at that list and ask yourself, are any of those things, you know, on your list because of an outside influence? Are you sure you really want to do that? Or maybe a societal pressure, maybe your parents, maybe your friends, maybe you think it'll sound cool. Because I think that that's it's a common problem. I think once you kind of root out those things, you can really get to the core of what makes your heart full. And, you know, I think that that's, I think that there's a lot that goes with that. And I think one of the reasons that that we slow down on attacking those kinds of things in general as we age, especially, is because we're settled into our identities, and a lot of our identities are shaped by outside influence. So breaking that mold, stopping and saying, why is that my identity? Was that like something that started back in, you know, did somebody tell me in the third grade that, you know, you don't like, you know, action sports, and I just kept that like with me, even though I ever check and make sure that's true or real? Or
yeah,
a lot of things like that happen.
I mean, that happens all the time. It's like, say like a kid is in even, you know, eighth grade or something, and they try art class and they're like, I'm bad at art. So when they're 50, they're like still thinking that they're bad at art, and they've never even tried again because someone told them that they were bad when they were a kid. And like, that's something that I actually did during like COVID, is I started like painting just for fun, you know, but I had always thought like I would be terrible at this, but that just wasn't true. Like it ended up being super fun, and I was like decent at it just because like I tried. And I didn't care about what other people thought, you know, but a lot of people don't do things because they care about what other people think of, like, you know, like how dare this person like try to paint or like write a joke or to sing or stuff like that, you know?
The book is a great example, because both of us have, you know, probably thought for a lot of our lives that, you know, writing a book was something that we probably couldn't do or was really hard on. And not only did we write a book, I actually have a second book that I've written unrelated, but the whole point actually I was going to make is now I found that I just enjoy writing. I want to write another book just because I want to do that, go through that process again, when that's a really powerful kind of learning, experiment, I guess, for people.
And by the way, it was really hard, but
it was extraordinarily hard.
You know, I noticed though that you two alternate chapters. So it's like, okay, if you're going to do a book, why not do it that way?
Honestly, I think that made it harder though, because it was like, I think it turned out like perfectly well because we did that, because there's alternating viewpoints and then we like come together at times, but it really made it difficult because we were trying to tell both of like our life stories and then all the stuff we did separately and together. But it turned out really well. It just made it a little bit more difficult, I would say.
Well, that's cool. I got one last question for you, and it's inspired by a childhood hero of mine, a guy named George Plimpton, who you may or may not have heard of. He's a journalist who wrote a book called Paper Lion. And he did, as a journalist, did all kinds of crazy sports things, like he, and other things. He actually did he boxed with a professional fighter. He became a professional musician. And this book, Paper Lion, where he highlights his tryout for the Detroit Lions. Of course, he was unsuccessful. But, you know, the idea that he chose to live multiple experiences within his career and within his life, you know, is that, like, should we all be looking to do that?
I mean, I love that personally. I'm on my third long-term career at this point. I'm 38 and I've had, you know, 10 years in music and 10 years of entrepreneurship and then, you know, speaking and writing and all that stuff. So I think it's great when people try new things. And I think that we should try new careers. But, and then obviously, like, if you're an entrepreneur, you have a lot more room for that, but you can do that mm-hmm. in, like, the corporate space as well. Like, even if you're like, I'm going to shadow someone in, like, marketing and you work in sales, like, you know what I mean? It could be, like, very, very simple like that. Or just, like, I'm going to go out tonight with the team from finance instead of my regular team. Like, there's just, like, little things that you can do in the corporate world as well.
And there's folks, I think, that go really deep and narrow on stuff. I mean, if you're a scientist and you're trying to map the genome or something, and the people that win the Nobel Prize are generally pretty deep on one specific topic, right?
Yes, they are.
Which is great, but that's not the majority of folks, right? Yeah. So the majority of people would do themselves a favor by broadening, you know, just their exposure to more things, to just maybe have more opportunities to enjoy life.
I think it's like we talk in the book about being like a polymath, right? It's like if you can be good at multiple things, then you're unique in that way. Like, say you're like, you know, really good at building websites, but you also can speak, you know, Mandarin, but you could also like do these things. Like, all of those things can come together at one point and like make you more unique and more valuable to like some employer or friend or whoever it might be.
Yeah. And one thing I noticed, and we didn't get into your whole story about your amateur winemaking. We'll do that another time. But the thing I loved about it was how you shared the experience with others. And so I guess what I'd like to wrap up on is, to what extent can becoming an experiential billionaire, you know, be a shared experience?
I mean, hopefully as much as possible. I think it is important to do things by yourself and have that relationship with yourself to be able to be comfortable. Because a lot of people don't do things because they literally can't be by themselves. Like, they'll be on their phone or they'll watch Netflix or whatever. They can't be without something else. So it's important to get there first. But then, like, I think having experiences with others, like, everything is better shared, you know, like. And that's how you build relationships, whether it's with your coworkers or with your, you know, your kids or your spouse or whoever it might be.
Yeah, all of our deepest, most meaningful relationships are based on experiences, you know, that we have together. And I think that at the end of our lives, at the very, very end of our lives, that's what we're going to think about, those people and that we have those relationships with, that we formed over those bonding moments and those experiences. And that's a really powerful thing. Nobody's on their deathbed asking to see their wallet one last time.
Yeah. Let's end on that note. And hopefully, Joe, your end of life experience won't be thinking of that as you go over the handlebars. mountain biking. I've done that. I'm sure you've done that.
Oh, but, yes.
Hey, let's wrap up. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. Today on the Stubbornly Young podcast, you've been listening to my conversation with authors of Experiential Billionaire, Bridget Hilton and Joe Huff. Joe, Bridget, glad you joined me. That was super fun.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Listeners, this has been episode 13 of the Stubbornly Young podcast for those in their 50s, 60s, and beyond, remaining engaged in the world and relevant to the younger people in their lives. Thanks for joining me. Please share with friends. On we go.